Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today, as part of our Pride Month coverage, we are celebrating LGBTQ plus authors whose books have been banned. In the first half of the 2023 school year, 4,349 books were banned across 23 states and 52 public school districts, according to PEN America. Collectively, the fall's bans impact millions of students. Books depicting LGBTQ plus characters and stories are most likely to face bans. In Republican-controlled states, lawmakers are passing draconian laws that restrict young people's access to books. They're also taking aim at librarians and school employees who defend challenged books. As of June 1st, Louisiana libraries must allow parents or guardians to decide which books their child can check out, according to the AP. Starting next month in Idaho, prosecutors will be able to, quote, bring charges against public and school libraries if they don't keep harmful materials away from children, end quote. Similar laws have also been enacted in Indiana, Missouri, Oklahoma, and Tennessee, according to the Washington Post. But voters overwhelmingly oppose these book bans, according to the American Library Association. So how are parents, students, and LGBTQ plus authors fighting back? Joining us today are two authors whose books have been banned. George M. Johnson is a Black, non-binary, queer activist and author. In their New York Times best-selling memoir, All Boys Aren't Blue, they explore their childhood, adolescence, and college years in New Jersey and Virginia. All Boys Aren't Blue explores gender identity, toxic masculinity, structural marginalization, consent, and Black joy. Since it was published in 2020, All Boys Aren't Blue has been one of the most banned books in the country. It was challenged 82 times just last year. George Johnson's second memoir, We Are Not Broken, was released in 2021, and they have a new book of essays about Black and queer icons from the Harlem Renaissance coming out this fall. It is called The Flamboyance, The Queer Harlem Renaissance, I Wish I'd Known. It sounds like a great book. Hi, George. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you for having me on again.
Great to have you. Melinda Lowe is a best-selling author of young adult fiction, including Last Night at the Telegraph Club, Ash, Huntress, A Line in the Dark, and A Scatter of Light, all of which have been targeted by book bans. Melinda Lowe's work has been banned, challenged, or restricted in 64 cases across 18 states. Last Night at the Telegraph Club, a New York Times bestseller, is the most frequent target. It tells the story of 17-year-old Lily Hu, who's exploring her sexuality and falling in love for the first time against the backdrop of 1950s San Francisco. The book has won many awards, including the National Book Award for Young People's Literature and the Asian Pacific American Award for Literature. Hi, Melinda. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, it's great to have both of you. You know, putting the show together, I was thinking, if their books had not been banned, would we be meeting them today? And I honestly don't know. So I'm glad to have you on. I wish that your books hadn't been banned. But I'm wondering, is it safe to assume, George, that because of these bans, more people might know about your book and you're probably doing more interviews than maybe if your book hadn't been banned?
I think that's safe to say. Yeah, I mean, my book came out in 2020, so to 4 years later, still be discussing the book, still having so many readers and fans, you know, new fans react to the book is amazing. I think the book bans did have, like, from a publicity standpoint, it had a reverse effect because there were people who didn't know that the book existed who needed the book. And so it did amplify it in a way that people who really, really needed to see themselves and see a character like themselves on the cover that didn't know that the book existed got to find out about it and got to read it and now have access to it. I think it harms us on the school and library side again, because, you know, some kids can't get access to it necessarily in a library, but it is making the book more aware and putting it out there for me, more people to know about it. And it's still growing. It's still getting new languages. And I think that, to me is, I guess, what continues to motivate me to fight against this, because I know that there are still so many who don't know the book exists that, could use it.
Right. So what has this experience overall been like for you?
Oh, so interesting. It changes, every couple months, I feel like. I feel like at the height of it, it was really, really, I wouldn't say it was scary. It just was daunting and overwhelming. That was probably February of 2022 when I was going toe to toe with, the Moms for Liberty over the book. That was really when things had like started to reach a real, fever pitch, so to speak. But for me, one, I think in them banning or attempting to ban All Boys Aren't Blue, it inspired me to write Flamboyant about the Harlem Renaissance. My notion was, if you're going to ban one of my books, you're going to have to ban all of them, because I'm going to keep writing about queer people. It made me want to go back into history and find out what their struggles were like in comparison to my own. It taught me that, you know, history repeats itself, because I'm on a list with Toni Morrison. And so... you know, it's just like, oh, like me and Toni Morrison are on the same banned book list. Like, okay. And that book came out over 40 years ago. Right. So it's been a journey. It's put me, you know, in a position to, I don't know. I live a purpose driven life is what I'll say. And so, some fights you don't choose, some fights choose you. This is one of the ones that chose me. And that's why I continue to live by Toni Morrison's quote. There's a book you want to read and it hasn't been written yet, then you must write it. And every time I'm looking for something I want to read or something I want to see on TV or something I want to see in a film, if it's not there, it pushes me to write it despite those who go against it.
Wow. Well, I'd love to hear more about The Flamboyance later in the show, because it sounds like a great book. That is George Johnson, who is author of the best-selling memoir, New York Times best-selling memoir, All Boys Aren't Blue. It has been one of the most banned books in the country. We're also joined by Melinda Lowe, a best-selling author of many works of young adult fiction. Melinda's work has been banned, challenged, or restricted in 64 cases across 18 states. And Melinda, I hope that even if these book bans hadn't gone into effect, that we would have somehow brought you on the show and learned about your incredible work. Do you also feel like because of these bans, more people know about your book? And do you think you're doing more interviews because of these bans?
I hope you would have brought me on the show in an alternate timeline. Absolutely. Yeah. I think that this is a really complicated question, because a lot of people kind of believe that having your book banned is a straight ticket to making teens want to read your book and then can lead to more book sales. And the problem is this doesn't happen for the vast majority of authors. I think it did happen for George. George is one who has, I guess, found a silver lining in this scenario. I'm so glad that people have found All Boys Aren't Blue, which is a very powerful book. And that's great. But I think that the vast majority of banned books do not receive any sort of publicity for it. I don't believe that I personally have seen a sales lift due to the book banning. Last night at the Telegraph Club was kind of a magical experience for me. It came out in January 2021, and it really grew throughout that entire year. It was not banned until the very end of 2021. I think that the popularity of that book really was organic and arose from the readers, and it didn't hurt that it won the National Book Award. So Since then, people have continued to find that book. And I think that Telegraph Club has lifted my backlist, but I honestly don't think it's because of the book banning. The problem is, once the book banning starts, a lot of the media thinks that this is the only thing you can discuss when it comes to books, especially books for young people. I think that the mainstream media often doesn't quite know how to talk about YA and children's books, but book banning is a hot topic and you can kind of structure stuff around that. So I think it's been it's a tricky question, and it is a belief that many people do have, but I don't think it's really borne out by the data. For books that are banned so much, like George's, the media does pick up on that. And it is the media exposure that brings people to the book. It's not necessarily the book banning.
This is a great point, Melinda, because whenever we do shows about this, behind the scenes, we make a conscious decision to not just focus on these book bans. I mean, we don't want you and George on the show today and to just ask you about what is happening in these Republican states. I mean, so much of it is negative and dark, and that's just not fair to both of you, because we also want to celebrate the work that you do, because it's so incredibly important. So I think that's such a good point. And then can you elaborate on what you said about how you think the media doesn't really understand young adult fiction when they spend so much time on these book bans? But what about the work that you're doing and the people that you're reaching?
Oh, this is also another huge question. Way to ask the easy questions, Rose. I think it's just because, you know, most adults, once you're no longer a teenager, you stop reading YA. So as an adult, if you don't read YA, it's probably an unfamiliar category to you. And so you're not quite sure what to do with it. And I think that a lot of adults who don't read YA have certain perceptions of it and think that it is there to do certain things, like teach young people lessons about life. But that's not necessarily the point of young adult literature. And I think it's very understandable that adults that don't read it don't quite know how to approach it.
So let's talk about your books. Melinda, in your book, Last Night at the Telegraph Club, you dedicate your book to all the butches and femmes, past, present, and future. Can you talk about who you hoped would find your book as you were writing it?
Well, I have to admit that as I am in the middle of writing a book, I honestly try to not think about potential readers at all because I don't want any imagined audience to influence the story and the characters. I really want to focus on the characters and who they are and tell their story. Of course, I think about the audience once I'm finished with the book and, you know, marketing comes into play. But this is something that is also very interesting because my books are published as young adult books and they're primarily marketed by my publisher toward teens. And that's absolutely correct. You know, teens are an audience for my book. But I also believe very strongly that an audience that I am writing for is young queer women from their teens through their 20s, young queer women who are experiencing a same-sex relationship for the first time, especially. So that's why I wrote that dedication. I was thinking about the generations of queer women who came before me, the ones who are alive now, and the ones who will be alive in the future. I'm really speaking to lifetimes of queer women.
And just to let listeners know a little bit more about your book, Last Night at the Telegraph Club, your protagonist is a 17-year-old Chinese-American girl coming to terms with her sexuality and falling in love for the first time, while also dealing with mounting suspicion and animosity towards her community during the Red Scare. So there's a lot going on there. I mean, what have you heard from young queer women who were affected by your book?
Well, I've been so fortunate to get messages throughout the years from queer readers who have connected with my stories. For example, my first novel, Ash, is a sapphic retelling of Cinderella, and it's set in a fantasy world where there's no homophobia. So it's totally normal to be queer. There's not even a word for queer or lesbian in that book because same-sex relationships are normal. So I have received so many messages from readers who connect with that and are so happy and excited to read a fairy tale set in a world where they can be queer and there are no problems with it. You know, that's not the problem. Being queer is not the issue in that book. So those are some of my most treasured reader emails and messages, you know, people who love to see themselves in a world where being queer is normal.
Wow. I mean, I love that, because the other thing we talk about when we do these shows is you can't ignore the dire statistics out there or the reality that is facing young LGBTQ plus youth today. The violence, the homelessness, there's just so much, and how in many cases it's gotten worse because of all of the bans and the horrific rhetoric we hear from mostly conservative politicians. So it's just nice, Melinda, to know that young queer people are finding these books where they can just be themselves. And I just love how you explained the book Ash, how these issues are not brought up. It's just, let's just celebrate and imagine this incredible world that we all would like to live in.
Yeah, I totally agree. And there's so many wonderful books out now. Definitely so many more than when I was a teen.
Melinda Lowe is a best-selling author of young adult fiction. She's written many books, including Last Night at the Telegraph Club, Ash, and Huntress. Melinda's work has been banned, challenged, or restricted in 64 cases across 18 states. We're also joined today by George Johnson, a Black non-binary queer activist and author. Their New York Times best-selling memoir, All Boys Aren't Blue, has been one of the most banned books in the country. It was challenged 82 times last year alone. George's second memoir, Mar, is called We Are Not Broken. And their new book coming out in the fall is The Flamboyance, The Queer Harlem Renaissance I Wish I'd Known. If you have any questions for our guest today, we'd love to hear from you. What books are you reading by LGBTQ plus authors? And if you found an LGBTQ plus book when you were young and it made a major impact on you, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. George, in your author's note for All Boys Aren't Blue, you wrote that you hope to give a voice to so many marginalized communities whose experiences have not yet been captured between the pages of a book. And then you came out with another memoir, We Are Not Broken. So can you talk to us about the reaction you've received from readers and any surprises that you've come across?
Yeah, the reaction from readers has been amazing. To Melinda's point, All Boys Aren't Blue was actually doing pretty well before the bans. I had already earned out my advance, so it was doing all right, because the readers really supported it. And like, I remember the most interesting thing was when the book first appeared on the banned book list at number 3. It also was the number 1 chosen book by teen readers from the American Library Association, right? So it had its own internal following and support. I think some of the most surprising things that have happened to me, I have had where LGBTQ youth, when I've traveled to do events at colleges, have me sign their books with their new chosen names, and them literally making the decision to go by their chosen name because they got to meet me and got to ask the questions they needed to give them the confidence to do so. I think one of my favorite moments was when I got to meet a group of 33 individuals that were all over the age of 60 who had a book club with All Boys Aren't Blue and got to talk about their experiences and how several of them were like, this was really the first time they felt like they felt seen. How me being a little kid that, or a little boy that used to love jump roping and double dutching, and like they were like, so did I, and nobody ever talks about that, or like I've never heard, it's nice to know that that is still a thing that is occurring with young kids. So that was like a really, really beautiful moment. It was a little bittersweet because it's like it shouldn't have taken that long for them to be able to feel seen, but I'm grateful that they were able to feel seen. And I'll say the most surprising moment was when a former member of the Moms for Liberty when the book was really, really being attacked in Kansas City, rather than just go with what the organization was saying about the book, she decided to read the book. And she made a very, very long post and she tagged me in it. And she said her main concern, you know, about the book was that she knew there were some graphic parts around sex and sexuality. And she said, she said she read the book. She kept reading. And she said, I kept waiting for the part to come. And then she said, but by the time I got to the part, I had already fallen in love with your grandmother. And so it didn't even matter anymore. Because she was like, the book wasn't about that. It was so much about family and love and support. And then she said when she got to the part, that's when she realized that everything had been taken out of context. Because she then said, at first I couldn't understand why you felt it was necessary. And she said, as I read the chapter and you were really trying to teach kids about consent and how to protect themselves and agency and the mistakes you made. And that's why you had to tell them what mistakes you made and what you went through. She was like, it changed her total view and she left the organization. And that to me is like part of like why I know I still have to continue to do this work, because I just didn't expect it. And
George,
I also
sorry, just to jump in there. This was a Moms for Liberty member.
Yes, former member now, but yes, you know, this post was probably 2 years ago. Yeah,
this just gives me the chills because it just shows. I mean, if we can just be real about this, a lot of people come at this from a place of fear, not knowing. They think they don't know anyone who's LGBTQ or trans or non-binary. Yeah. And maybe in their community, all they hear is negative comments.
Yes.
And I mean, it's just, it's amazing what happens when someone can be exposed to this work. And I mean, she left Moms for Liberty. This is an incredible story.
Yeah. And I think what it taught me, though, like in the grand scheme of things, is that the people who are banning books also don't read books. So they literally just pull the quotes and they all share the same exact quotes. I believe for me, it's page 268, 270 and 272. And that's all they share of the book. And then they paint the picture like this is the entire book. And no one ever actually goes back to read the book. And so to have someone say like, no, go read the whole book and then make a determination, right? It is the whole notion of judging the book by its cover. People have primarily judged our books based off of passages, not the entirety of the work, but just a passage. And it's like, if you take one passage, or in my case, it was mainly three passages from a book that's over 300 pages long and you didn't read anything else in the book, what actually are you trying to ban? And so that's really been the question.
Right. That's an amazing story. We've done some shows about Moms for Liberty, but just to remind listeners, they're a well-funded organization that advocates for curriculum, against curriculum that mentions LGBT rights, race and ethnicity, critical race theory, discrimination. We've done a few shows about Moms for Liberty. Amazing story, George. Melinda, what about you? Do you have any similar stories or surprises you've come across at events you'd like to share with us?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, George's experience with that Moms for Liberty, former Moms for Liberty person, is the dream, right? Like I always hoped that, you know, if these book banners would just read my books, they would then understand what I was getting at and they wouldn't then ban them. And I mean, I think that can still definitely happen. Obviously, it has happened in some cases. I was very surprised and unfortunately disheartened when I did have the chance to read a challenge form for my novel Ash that was posted on social media. And it was a mom in Texas who had read Ash. And she had this little review of the book and she was like, this is such a wonderful novel. It shows the kind of true love that we would really want our children to experience. But because the main character falls in love with another woman, I cannot allow my child to read this book. Therefore, it should be banned. So I was so stunned by this because it was clear that the book had affected her and she had certainly understood it. But her agenda was much more powerful than any empathy that my novel might have raised in her.
Hmm. Wow. What about any stories around empathy, any interactions you've had around empathy that may have surprised you or has stood with you?
Honestly, I think that one takes the cake for now.
Yeah.
Okay. I do.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a very sad moment for me.
Wow.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a quick break. Today, we're marking Pride Month by celebrating LGBTQ plus authors whose books have been banned. That is Melinda Lowe. Melinda is a best-selling author of many young adult novels, including Last Night at the Telegraph Club, a New York Times bestseller and the most frequent target. It tells the story of 17-year-old Lily Hu, who is exploring her sexuality and falling in love for the first time against the backdrop of 1950s San Francisco. The book has won many awards, including the National Book Award for Young People's Literature. George Johnson is a non-binary queer activist and author. Their New York Times bestselling memoir, All Boys Aren't Blue, has been one of the most banned books in the country. It was challenged 82 times just last year. George's second memoir, We Are Not Broken, was released in 2021, and their new book of essays about Black and queer icons from the Harlem Renaissance is coming out this fall. It's called The Flamboyance, The Queer Harlem Renaissance I Wish I'd Known. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have an intergenerational conversation with LGBTQ plus activists about Pride Month and how they are fighting back against ongoing Republican attacks on their communities. Then we'll discuss extreme weather events around the globe and the climate questions that should be asked during tomorrow night's presidential debate. What questions are you hoping to hear tomorrow night? If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. If you'd like to join today's conversation with George Johnson and Melinda Lowe, two LGBTQ plus authors whose books have been banned, we'd love to hear from you, especially if you have any questions about their work and how they approach their work. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. If you have been affected by a book by an LGBTQ plus author, we'd love to hear from you. If you have any overall thoughts about these book bans, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. We have a email from a listener who says, I cannot believe this is happening in 2024. What is being done to turn this around? Melinda, do you want to take that first? I mean, what are you hearing from other young adult novelists, and what are you seeing out there about the reaction to this?
Well, I think that, I mean, all young adult novelists and all, certainly all LGBTQIA writers are horrified by all the book banning. And I think very recently, a whole group of them organized under the name Authors Against Book Bans. So that's a very new organization that is attempting to work on the local level to fight book bans, for example, by going to school board meetings, sending authors to those, and supporting the teachers and librarians in those local school board meetings. So that's certainly one thing that has recently arisen. I'm very proud to be a plaintiff on a lawsuit against the state of Iowa's book banning law that, the lawsuit is funded by my publisher, Penguin Random House, and includes several other authors and teachers and librarians from the state of Iowa. I'm very proud to have that opportunity to stand up for the First Amendment and fight the book bans in court.
George, what would you add? What do people need to know about what's happening on the ground to fight against these bans?
Yeah, I am also part of a federal lawsuit in Florida, in Escambia County, where we are fighting against the book bans, myself, several authors, several students and their parents, as well as some publishers. And I actually have to do my deposition in July as our case is moving forward. So we are taking it to the courts. That is one way that we have been able to fight against this. Some of the other groundwork that's being done shout out to the Brooklyn Public Library for making all banned books accessible across the country for young adults through a program that they have that has been really going well. I also, my mother has been to a school board meeting with my aunts, and they kept the book on the shelf 20 minutes from where I grew up in Plainfield, New Jersey. So, you know, it's my family is also a part of this fight. But yeah, I think like and also the student activists. I just want to make sure I give a big, big, big shout out to the student activists who have done petitions, who have showed up and showed out at school board meetings, who have walked out of school, who have done the true groundwork to protect their rights as students to have access to resources. Because that's what this is really about. It's not just about books. It's about an access to a resource material that they could need for a variety of reasons, right? Not just for them learning about themselves, but them learning about the world. And so student activists have really, really been on the ground doing a lot of movement work in the trenches to protect book rights.
George, you're just reminding me of this incredible documentary we featured earlier this year called The ABCs of Book Banning. It's just this beautiful documentary. The entire documentary is young, very young children who sound so much more, I have to say it, intelligent than a lot of the people who are banning these books. And it's just, it's amazing because we never hear from children. It's just so rare to hear from children. And these kids are reading, you know, Ibram X. Kendi, and they're learning about racism, and they're maybe 10 or 11 years old. And it's just incredible. And I think it's important to focus on that because the bans get so much attention. But the fact is, these kids are seeking out this information, and they are so incredibly smart.
Yes, absolutely. I am grateful for the documentary, The ABCs of Book Ban. I got to participate in multiple panels and speak about it as we were pushing forward to get that Oscar. but they didn't get it, but it's still an amazing, amazing documentary. And I think what it actually highlights and what it actually showcases is the books are not necessarily introducing many of these kids to these topics. The books are giving them the knowledge that they need to fully process the topics. And what the most fraudulent part about book banning is that there is this notion that, oh, we are banning the books because we need to protect the children. It's like, no, these children live in the real world, and they are already experiencing racism from a young age, and homophobia and transphobia and misogyny, and they're experiencing that. And the books give them context about what to do in those situations, how to process it, how to navigate their own identities. It's not just an introductory tool for them. And I think that seeing kids that young talk about these subjects lets you know they didn't necessarily get these subjects from the books. They had already been thinking about these things, hearing about certain words like gay and lesbian. And I always talk about, like, the first time I heard the word lesbian was on a show about to age myself called Murphy Brown. And I was watching it with my mom, and I was like, what's a lesbian? And she was like, well, and she explained it to me. And I was like, okay, we went back to watching Murphy Brown. But if I then wanted to go further to learn what a lesbian was, I would have went and grabbed a dictionary. I would have went and grabbed a book that said something with the title lesbian on it. And then I would have read about it. But my access point was the TV show, right? And so the books give you the context. And so watching those kids be so profound in their words lets you know they're actually navigating the real society. And the books are what are helping them to grasp it and to fully understand it and process it for themselves.
Mm. Yeah, well, I hope everyone can see the ABCs of book banning. It's really an amazing short documentary. Well, thank you for the question. We have a number of callers on the line. And again, today we're speaking with George Johnson and Melinda Lowe, authors of incredible books that have been banned. I hope you can take the time to learn more about their work at yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Paul in Mill Valley. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for allowing me to speak, and a good show. I'd like to suggest perhaps a modest proposal to attend some of these school board meetings and perhaps move forward to ban some young Christian youth books like Who I Am and Why Do I Matter. You never know. They may get the point, and you might get a swift response that you had hoped to educate them on.
So take part in a little bit of satire. Well, thank you, Paul. We'll get responses after we take a few more callers. Let's go to Jean in Santa Cruz. Hi, Jean. Welcome to the show. Oh, is Jean still there? Well, Jean, if you can give us a call back, we'll put you right on the air. Let's go to John in Berkeley. Hi, John.
Hello. First of all, I want to thank you both for your excellent work and all everyone listening. But as a historian, one of the first things that fascism does is ban books and then burn them. Then you get thugs and you take over the administrative apparatus and you never leave power. And so their one book is the Nazi Seizure of Power, which is the playbook. But my point is really the funny story that when the Nazis burned books, they pulled out all the books that had been banned and made a big fire. And Bertolt Brecht, the playwright, they did not burn his books. And he was so angry that he bought all his books and made a big fire and said, "How dare you burn books and not burn mine?"
Well, in the ABCs of book banning, they do focus on a banned book, Anne Frank's Diary, the graphic adaptation by Ari Folman. So thank you for that comment. It just made me think about tomorrow night's debate. And, you know, it would be great if one of the moderators said, okay, do you support book bans? And to go into this a little bit. I mean, what are your thoughts on that, George? How can, because the fact of the matter is, according to the American Library Association, voters overwhelmingly oppose book bans, 70% Democrats, 70% Republicans. I mean, it's overwhelming, not surprising. But what are your thoughts about, you know, bringing questions around these issues to a higher level, like the presidential debate? I don't know. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think that's even important?
I actually do think it's extremely important, and just it's extremely important, and this is why. I always say, like, you know, the rhetoric that comes from one side in regards to book bans is extremely loud, but for me, the problem has been the silence from the other side at times. And what you have to take away from that is that some of them also don't necessarily agree that our books should be taught to their kids. But they don't want to publicly say that, right? Because they need to appear that, no, we are staunch defenders of the freedom to read and access to read. But and that happens a lot. Like, I've just seen it happening, right? Like, when Senator Kennedy read my book at a Senate Judiciary hearing, there were no outcries from, you know, people from, you know, Democratic side, like, opposing it or stating it was out of context or any of that, right? And so it actually should be a question that is starting, that starts to get brought up to them where they actually have to answer it in real time. Because what I've just learned is that people, like, you have, like, on the right, they're very staunch in, like, what their standpoint is. And then at times on the left, they take the neutral standpoint, which is everybody should have access. But what they don't say is, do you agree that this book is okay?
Right.
Right? And that's the part that bothers me the most and scares me the most, because it's almost like they kind of get away without ever having to say what they actually feel about certain issues, because they just say, well, everybody should have access to it. You know, everybody should have access to books. It's like, well, yes, we understand that. But what do you actually feel about these books? Have you read these books? Right? Because they're saying their part out very, very loudly. You all are just saying, no, books shouldn't be banned. And I think the biggest takeaway is, like, we continually keep watching rights that are being taken away that the public doesn't agree with. At some point, the public has to realize you have to start choosing policy, not party. And that's been the biggest issue, right? Because it's like, well, 70% of Republicans don't think books should be banned, and 70% of Democrats don't think books should be banned. But then you have a candidate who comes up who wants to protect books. Are those Republicans going to vote for that candidate if that candidate is a Democrat that wants to protect books, right? Because we know all Republicans are ready to throw away, for the most part, who are running politicians are ready to throw away books and burn books and get rid of books. And that's what actually becomes the problem, right? When do you start actually voting for policies that better your life or that go with what you actually believe in versus, well, I don't like, yes, that person is right, but also this is my party, so I don't want to cross that line.
Right. Melinda, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think it would be really great if people started taking book banning seriously, like genuinely seriously, like that the caller who said that fascism starts with book banning is correct. I mean, this is one of the first steps toward fascism. And I think that, you know, I'm an immigrant to this country. I came here from China when I was about 3.5 years old. I grew up knowing that we came to this country in part because we did not have freedom of speech in China. So for me, the First Amendment is really important. It is a foundational ideal of American democracy. And our country is certainly not perfect. But I think that the First Amendment is really important. And I think that I don't see a lot of people taking this challenge to the First Amendment seriously. Like, it's very easy if you live in a blue state, especially, to be like, that's just a red state problem. Or, you know, they're not really banning books. They're just making a lot of noise. No, they're really banning books. They are literally removing thousands of books from libraries. And their goal is not merely to stigmatize LGBTQ identities and people. It is to remove history that they don't agree with from the curriculum. Mm-hmm. It is to change the curriculum to reflect a much more conservative ideology. Like, this is actually a very serious problem. And I think it's very easy to be kind of flippant about it and be like, but they don't really mean that, or it's not affecting me and I live in Massachusetts. So, you know, but it is very serious, and it is a real offense against the First Amendment. So I would be happy if it was mentioned seriously at a national level.
Yeah. No, it's a great point. You reminded me of a show we did with activists in Tennessee and Florida. And they said, you know, don't think that what's happening here cannot happen where you live.
Absolutely.
Because you could be next.
That's right.
And it is happening where they live, right? I think that's part of it too, is like, it gets put into, which is why, like, my whole fight has always been, which maybe that's why I identify as non-binary, because my whole fight has been, we have got to get out of the binary. And so we talk about it like, oh, well, red states do this and blue states do that. It's like, well, no, because there are Republican counties in LA where I live that are banning books. So just because your state is a blue state does not mean that there are not a swath of red counties that are still banning books. So it's not a red state, blue state issue. It's an issue. And we all need to be fighting against the issue.
Right. Well, we have Jean back. So let's hear from Jean in Santa Cruz. Hi, Jean.
Oh, hi. I'm glad to talk with you. I'm glad that you're writing. Keep on doing it. Keep on being brave. I'm a 74-year-old lesbian identified woman. I was a teacher. When I was in my career, it was illegal to be homosexual. So those kinds of avenues for us to be open were shut down. And I'm currently writing a book about two women in San Francisco in the 50s. I grew up in the 50s, and I'm just happy to know that you're validating history, too, because our history is really important, and it hasn't been able to be brought out. And those times in when I was born and when I grew up were tough. I mean, you asked about one time, what were we reading? I was reading Little Women. I mean, that was kind of about it. And so I just wanted to congratulate you for doing that and letting stories be known, because I was a middle school teacher just 10 years ago, and kids are very much more open now because of you and because of the things that you're writing, and I appreciate the efforts that you're making. So thank you.
Oh, well, that's amazing, Jean. Thank you so much for calling in. To Jean's point, Melinda, you know, just getting back to the importance of ensuring that people have access to your books. In your best-selling book, Last Night at the Telegraph Club, we follow your protagonist, Lily, as she's exploring her attraction to girls And you can see in her environment how rare it is for her to come across any media that reflects her experience and how she clings to it when she finds it, like a paperback describing a sexual encounter between two women or a newspaper clipping about a male impersonator performing at a local club. And this just shows how kids want information that gives them context about what they're experiencing and who they are. So can you talk about that? Because it's so concerning. If books like yours are not available, how are kids going to find this information?
Oh, yeah. You know, first of all, shout out to Jean. You know, I loved Little Women too. that's what I had as a kid. You know, there weren't any books like mine when I was a teen. And that's really one of the reasons I write the books that I do. I think that, teens today have a one major benefit that I did not have, which is the internet. So, you know, you can take books out of schools, but I think that teens are going to find a way to access the information they want. And that information may not be as great as the kind that you can find in a published book. So I hope that, we need to remember where we are now. I mean, 2024 is so different than the 80s when I grew up or the 1950s. It's a very different time and there's so much out there and it's just streaming toward our young people at, you know, so fast and so overwhelmingly. And it sometimes shocks me that these book banners are so focused on books because there's so much else out there for them to be angry about.
Right. What are your thoughts on that, George?
Yeah. I mean, it's just so interesting because I'm like, I also read Little Women, but my experiences are different.
Love it.
But yeah, I mean, it's baffling. Like, and I think that's like after all the years that, like, because it's now been years we've been fighting against the book bans. To me, it's all just so baffling because they have the internet as a resource, and so it's like they can still find so many other things and still research so many other things in a myriad of different ways. And so, like, banning books is just, I think it's like it's what do we want to say? It's a play out of the old playbook, right? Like, it's literally just from the old playbook. And
yeah. Yep.
Because I truly believe in, like, Toni Morrison's words and the things that she, you know, have taught us, it's like we have to realize this is just history repeating itself. And so I oftentimes find myself laughing when I think about the Moms for Liberty, because I'm a big Golden Girls fan. And I think about the episode where Blanche wanted to be a part of the Daughters of, like, the Confederacy or whatever they called it. But that's really just what they are. It's the Daughters of the Confederacy under a new name. And if you start to realize how history repeats itself, that's important. That's why I keep writing about history so much. And I'm writing about the Harlem Renaissance because it gives us the playbook of how they fought it. And so in looking at it, it's like these are just new groups under the same mentality and the same name. But these groups fizzled out for a reason. And so there's a, you know, and we have to follow the playbook. And again, book banning is the first sign of fascism. And it just is something that needs to be taken seriously because we're dealing with very unserious people. I always say, like, you know, we just have to be honest. These people are not smart, but they're very organized. And so, you know, when you have a lot of people who are unintelligent but organized, it creates a dangerous situation. Mm-hmm. These are people who have tried to ban my books in libraries where my book wasn't there. And, like, mm-hmm. the librarian would have to go, yeah. Like, we don't have this book. Like, we literally do not have the book in the library, but we'll order it now. And then you can try to ban it once we get it. Like, that's how unserious this fight is. And so, mm-hmm. Boggling, mm-hmm. mind-boggling. Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks again for the call, Jean. We have another great comment from Sandy, and then we'll have to end the show. Sandy writes, when I was living in Nevada, it was the 80s, and coming to terms with my emerging sexuality, a lesbian friend who was a librarian recommended that I read Annie on My Mind by Nancy Garden. She could not have recommended a better book. A YA work of fiction, I felt that it was a memoir of my high school years. For the first time ever, I wrote to an author. To my surprise, Nancy Gardner wrote me back. Her letter was warm and supportive. She shared, "As you probably figured out, Annie in my mind is autobiographical." Sandy writes, "Her book and letter, along with my librarian friend, encouraged me to accept who I was and am." Ah, amazing letter, Sandy. And it really speaks to the power of the work that you're both doing. You never know who you're going to reach. I mean, and that's why it's so important for your work to get out there. Final thoughts from both of you about, I mean, this moment we're in is, there's just so much. It's shocking, really. I mean, we're getting other emails that just say, thank you for your work. I'm still shocked that this is happening. Melinda, final thoughts mm-hmm. from you about where you think this is going. We have about a minute left.
I don't know where it's going, but I know what I want to say, especially to young queer people, is that there is nothing shameful about being queer. Like, these book banners are trying to shame us. And I just mm-hmm. want young queer people to know there's nothing to be ashamed of. We're great.
Great. Thank you for that. George, your final thoughts?
Yeah, my final thoughts are, you know, because I've been doing activism work for a long time, I mean, since I was a teenager with my grandmother, this feels like one of those moments where, you know how they used to talk about Antifa? It was Antifa, 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 then they stopped talking about Antifa. And then it was BLM, and it was BLM, 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 and now you never hear them talk about BLM. And then it was woke, 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 woke. And then their own party was like, the young Republicans were like, okay, that's stupid. We actually do want to be awake. Like, this feels like it could potentially be one of those things that it's just like, ban books, ban books, ban books, ban books, ban books. Oh, wait a minute. We have another issue we could fight, because this one is not really polling well anymore, and it's ranking 17 on the exit ballots, or most of the exit ballots is ranking between 17 and 23 as a top issue for voters. It could just all go away, or it could get worse. So to the young people out there, stay motivated, make sure you vote, and, you know, protect your rights.
Hmm. George Johnson is the author of the New York Times bestselling memoir, All Boys Aren't Blue, one of the most banned books in the country. We Are Not Broken, another memoir, was released in 2021, and The Flamboyance, The Queer Harlem Renaissance I Wish I'd Known, will be coming out this fall. Melinda Lowe is bestselling author of many young adult novels, including Huntress, Ash, and Last Night at the Telegraph Club. You can find more information about Melinda's incredible work at yourcallradio.org, along with George Johnson's work. George and Melinda, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to Savannah Harriman-Pote for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. And thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.